Hey, football fans, this is Diana Rossini from The Athletic. Get the top stories in pro football snapped directly to your inbox with our latest NFL newsletter, Scoop City. Jacob Robinson and I will bring you the daily scoop of top NFL articles, posts, and podcasts every Monday to Friday. Sign up for free now at theathletic.com/scoop.
This is The Athletic Football Show.
Welcome to The Athletic Football Show. Today is Tuesday, January 18th. I'm Robert Mays. Joining me today is my good friend Mitchell Schwartz. Mitch, how you doing, buddy?
I'm good. A lot of football being watched this past weekend.
It's been a lot. We'll get into that. We'll talk about the schedule and what it made the games look like. Just a little organizational stuff before we get going here. You guys hopefully will be listening to this on Tuesday at some point during the day. We are recording this before Cardinals-Rams, but we will have a reaction to Cardinals-Rams in the feed by the time you guys listen to this. So just giving you a sense, if something insane happens in the Cardinals-Rams game, this is why we are not addressing it, because we're recording before that game happens. So I just wanted to lay that out for everyone so they understood the timeline on which this stuff is happening.
That's a good disclaimer. I don't know you're able to play with time like that, so you need to definitely add that to your Wikipedia page.
It's really the only strength I have as a podcast host. So obviously, over the course of the season, when we've done these Tuesday shows, they've been mailbags. We are going to incorporate some listener questions into the shows that we're going to do during the playoffs, but I felt like it was so silly to not use your insight on the biggest games of the season, on the games where all of these moments become so much bigger and so much more important and analyzed and crucial. So we're going to go back and kind of do some second day analysis of some of the wildcard games that happened last weekend, along with some mailbag questions over the course of the rest of the year. So hopefully that sounds good to everybody. I want to start with the Cowboys situation. Now that we've had, it's 3:45 Central Time on Monday, okay? So we've had about 24 hours to process the end of that game, some of the decision-making in that game. As somebody who has dealt with just the free-for-all, weird nature of some of those in-game decision-making moments, now that you've had a day to breathe, I need your take on what happened in Dallas and what those decisions looked like for Mike McCarthy and the Cowboys.
It's like an avalanche. It just, the snowball keeps getting bigger and bigger, and I just think it's dumber and dumber.
now that you've had more time to analyze it, it's gotten stupider.
Yeah. It was really bad in the moment, and then I've thought about it a lot and talked about it and considered it from all angles, and I've seen McCarthy try to throw his analytics staff under the bus. And
that was fake, by the way. That was not real. That was not real. That was not a real quote.
We all believed that that was real?
It says a lot. You got to keep your head on a swivel when it comes to quotes on the internet. We live in a world of aggregation where anything could be possible. Double check everything.
So here's the problem. So I keep a pretty tight timeline. I don't really follow too many people. So I read most of the things on my timeline because I follow those people for specific reasons. Like, some of them are friends, some of them are for fun, some of them are for football. So that obviously came across my timeline, and whoever put it out there is not a good person, because they did not throw a follow up and say, hey, just to let you know, this was fake. It's not true. So I'm not going to go back and try to find who put it on there. But people, if you get duped by a fake, you got to put it out there that it's fake, because this type of thing happens. So please do better next time.
So obviously, I mean, there's a lot to dig into. Which of those decisions, which of those scenarios was the most troubling to you?
The most troubling was the last one, the 14-second QB draw, because there's a lot of things wrong with it. They were just on the precipice of not having enough time to run a play and then be able to safely get it to the line and spike it. We saw that obviously pan itself out. I don't really agree with the play call either, because Dak has to catch the snap, kind of do a quasi fake. The O-line has to block it all correctly. Now, there were only three defensive linemen at the time, but like, one of those guys can slip off. It's not necessarily the easiest thing to just run through the middle. And then Dak has to run from, I think they were, what, the 40-yard line? So he catches it at the 45, 44-yard line. takes a step back to the 46, and then he's got to run all the way to like the 30 to really make it worth anything. So he's running 16 yards, going from a complete standstill. Well, if he catches it and just throws it to one of his receivers who's already 8 or 10 yards downfield, if you go back and watch or see the screenshots, like those receivers are all wide open because San Fran is covering the sidelines because they realize really anything in the field of play is fine. We can give that up. So Dak could just take it.
Reasonably so at that point in the game, by the way.
Right.
They were right.
Yeah. He could take it, throw a little missile to one of his receivers. That guy just takes a knee, and then you're taught you either run the ball to the hash, place it down, or you hand it directly to a ref. The things you don't do are hand it to a teammate, and the thing you really don't do is you don't throw the ball. Throwing the ball is awful because that requires the ref who's running full speed to spot the ball, to catch the ball, make sure he catches it, secure it, and then put it down. So throwing the ball to the ref is the worst thing you can do. So they failed at all these...
Don't trust the hands of the ref. Seems like a sound strategy.
Well, it's true because there's the good teams who coach it up correctly. They'll show you the clips of guys throwing it to refs and then the ref bobbles it and the game is over or the half is over. Like that.
How much time do you guys spend on this shit?
Like, every week?
Every single week. In what capacity? Is it during practice? Is it in meetings? Is it a certain period called a certain thing? Like, what is the actual preparation for moments like this look like?
It's Friday and Saturday, typically. You'll go over these kind of end of game situations, end of half situations. So everyone should have plays that cover these scenarios. So sometimes they're evolving, right? So a couple years ago, New Orleans was playing Houston, might have been the first or second week of the season. I think they were at like the 45-yard line and needed to get in field goal range for whatever reason. Houston was playing off coverage. So New Orleans took the snap, you know, threw a little 6-yard hitch route, caught it. Everyone on the team is signaling timeout. It's excellent. They get up, they kick the 55-yarder, Lutz makes it, and they win. And so that's a play like, oh, this is a situation. Like, we have plays for this, but maybe we can create a specific play for this specific situation. So then we did that, and then we had a play that was like that. Now, you have something like that already in, and in the huddle, the guys, you know, the coordinator and the head coach are telling the quarterback, hey, we're in this situation, make sure this happens. But coaches like things simple, so they like to be able to say, like, oh, it's Hail Mary, and, like, everyone knows what to do. So you've got these special situations. You go over them on Friday, typically at some point, either in Friday's practice or in Saturday's walkthrough. You're hitting these situations, end of game plays, you know, the Hail Marys, the trick plays, the reverses, the situational football that you need to, because I mean, you practice that all year and it barely comes into play. Like, those situations rarely come into play, but when they do, it's game defining. So you better have covered it, and you better cover it often enough, because there are, you know, certain checks at the line of scrimmage, say the quarterback can make, that you put in training camp, and then it's the third week of the season and the quarterback's at the line yelling like Ringo, Ringo, and everyone's just like looking like, what the hell is Ringo? We haven't done that in like 6 weeks. So it has to be fresh. You have to cover it every week because it's that important. So most teams do cover that. I'm not saying the teams don't do it, but on the back end, from the coaching perspective, like, they need to utilize those situations. Like, for all those things, we're told, like, hey, if there's X amount of time, you can do this. If there's, you know, say 6 seconds instead of 7 seconds, or 12 seconds instead of 14 seconds, like, that unlocks this ability on this play. This unlocks this other option on the play. So you should be going through all those. You cover 2-minute stuff every week. You cover end of game situations every week. It just seemed like a failure of not knowing that, like, 14 seconds is just on the precipice of not being able to get the spike off. We saw that was the case. I think they could have done a quicker play by just having Dak throw to a wide receiver who was running full speed ahead at the snap, especially when you get to the line and you see that there's no one in the middle of the field. And then the wide receiver,
and maybe he's somebody, maybe somehow, some way, somebody slips, you can duck out of bounds. To me, it's about upside and downside. There's only downside, in my opinion, to the draw. Like, the fact that there is no high-end levels of the outcome is really important when you're considering which plays to use in that scenario.
Right. So the other thing is, why don't you just have 2 or 3 Hail Marys? Like, why don't you just start throwing it at the end zone? Because, you know, I've seen it argued that, like, oh, well, Dallas probably wouldn't have won the game anyway, so we need to not give them such a hard time. And, like, I get that sentiment. Realistically, one play from the 25, you're probably not going to score a touchdown. But wouldn't you rather have 14 seconds from the 40 and have 2 or 3 chances at the end zone? And we see these Hail Marys, obviously pass interference is almost never called. They're usually the last play of the game. We haven't really seen a Hail Mary that's not the last play of the game or like the fourth down call. So
how long do you have to get that off though? Do you have two, can you get two Hail Marys off in 15 seconds?
If you've got a quality clock operator and you're playing at home, you know, no, but I mean, even two chances, I mean, would you say, I'm sure there's stats on it, but like two chances from the 40 versus one chance from the 25. And I'd imagine they probably told Dak, like, you're not supposed to run for 15 or 16 yards. You're supposed to go down, you know, a little bit sooner. So having two chances at something squirrely happening, a pass interference, a tip ball that you catch, some other thing that happens. I mean, they've got, that was the big mismatch for the Cowboys, right? Is their receiving group against the 49ers DBs. So like anything can happen in that situation. I don't know. It just seemed like I'd rather take a few more chances at the end zone than running a play that is that risky in that situation to try to spike it to get a little bit more yardage to just run a similar play anyway.
So if you're a member of the Dallas Cowboys now and you're staring at this offseason and you're thinking about the way that game ended, and we don't really know what Mike McCarthy is like day to day as a head coach. I don't know. I can't speak to it. I haven't talked to players there about it. I have no idea. I know what it was like at the end in Green Bay. That's what I have to go on. What are you thinking about next year and what it is going to look like and what it should look like? Is it hard to kind of drum up enthusiasm for whatever that staff is and whatever the status quo is after it ends like that?
Yeah, I mean, probably. I would say as a player, you're aware of the narratives that surround your coach. You know, for Coach Reed, it was like, oh, he can't handle end-of-game situations for forever. And it's like, all right, that's dumb. Like, again, I'm in all those meetings. I know he's very in tune to the end-of-game situations. He's got, you know, a bunch of people in the box helping him out. And that was just like a dumb narrative. So if the Cowboys players are feeling like McCarthy's a good coach to be around day-to-day, they like the decisions, they like the atmosphere, all that, I don't think they'll come back and be like, oh man, this guy sucks, we should have fired him, and I wish they went with someone else. Kind of same thing with like Kellen Moore. Obviously Dan Quinn had a huge impact on that defense. They all love him. But if the players love their coordinators and or the head coach, you know, the work environment's fine and everyone gets juiced and they'll come into next year, they'll have all this talent and they'll be highly touted and we'll expect a lot of them. So I don't think it's necessarily something that the whole team is going to be like, man, we need to move on, we're going to tune this guy out, he failed us in the playoffs. If that is the case, I mean, they need to tell Jerry. It does seem like there is a line of communication from the players to Jerry, I think maybe more than other ownerships, because Jerry's always around, he's there. I'm sure he loves being around the guys and hanging out and talking and all that stuff. And so I would imagine he leans on those guys as well, and he can talk to Dak, he can talk to Tyron, he can talk to Zach Martin, just be like, hey, you know, tell us about McCarthy, what do you think? Now, they've put out a statement today that seems like he's going to be back next year, so I don't think there's going to be any change from that perspective. But there's probably a few guys who are like, man, this guy sucks, and yesterday just like confirmed that for them, but I don't think it's like a tune-out situation or where he's just going to be completely useless.
All right. It's time to talk about Kellen Moore, because this has been an ongoing discussion, right, throughout this entire season. And I'm guilty of it. I'd fully admit it. When bad things happen to the Cowboys, we attribute them to Mike McCarthy. When good things happen to the Cowboys, we attribute them to Kellen Moore. We had a couple questions from listeners. Sean Dolan asked this, and Jeff, who is a Packers fan, asked a version of it. Is Kellen Moore good? Are we sure Kellen Moore is good? And you wanted to dig into this because you have some thoughts.
Yeah, I'm not sure of it. I don't watch them enough with like that critical scheme eye to know like, oh, this is a really advanced passing scheme. I know they were having a really good season. Dak hurt his calf, came back, just hasn't quite looked the same since. But I watch a decent amount of Cowboys football, and I don't ever walk away thinking like, man, this offense is steamrolling people and the scheme is awesome and it's just like this revolutionary thing. Like, I think people liked him because he threw the ball a lot and they scored points, and that was kind of in vogue, and obviously still is. We talk about this all the time in terms of leaning a little more pass heavy. It just, I don't know. I don't get the feeling that he's, you know, a cutting edge coordinator. I think we could all see it pretty evidently from Shanahan, from McVay, from some of these other guys. With Moore, it was the raw stats that jumped off the page. I mean, Dak, before he broke his ankle, was on pace to set all the throwing records. Now, part of that is they were down and they were throwing the ball early in 2020. This year, of course, the stats are good and they're a top five offense and stuff, but you look at the personnel and that's kind of where they should be. And I don't think they're necessarily outperforming that. They seem to have all these performances that just kind of prove that it's not the offense that we think. And again, in this day and age, we look towards the coordinator, and if the offense is putting up stats and points, which the Cowboys have, we just think he's awesome. I guess I just don't get the sense watching them that I feel like he's a guy that is on the level of some of the other great coordinators we've seen. And I think in terms of him being a head coach, I mean, you go to the way he looks and the demeanor and stuff and the stuff that shouldn't matter, but we obviously know it does matter when you're interviewing and when you're going to become the face of a franchise. And something, you know, Pat Shurmur in New York got criticized about for 2 years is that he was too quiet and wasn't quite energetic enough and too dry and all this stuff. So there's a combination of all these things. And I just don't really leave Cowboys games feeling satisfied that the offense put their best foot forward and that schematically they were put in the best position.
The word I used last night and the word that I will keep coming back to after watching the game again this morning and watching all 22 after reading Seth Galina's piece on PFF, which I actually thought was very good and very illuminating. You guys should go check it out about this exact topic, is static. It feels static. And there are, I think that Seth did such a great job and I'm really articulating some of the things that you can feel when you watch them. And it's that just because you have a quarterback that's really, really good at understanding 1 to 2 to 3, this is where I should go with the ball based on where defenders are, doesn't mean that should be the entire engine for what your passing offense looks like. You shouldn't make it hard on your quarterback because he's capable of doing hard things.
Yeah. So I'm going to interrupt you there. So I had the same or very similar observation yesterday when you said static, that's perfect. Because I feel like there were all these pieces throughout the year about how Dak is this like mentally advanced quarterback and he is as good before the snap as anybody. But we just watched before that Tom Brady eviscerate the Eagles and like,
yeah,
he catches a snap, balls out. He catches a snap, balls out. I didn't see the all 22 version, but like you don't see that kind of quick strike ability from Dak to the level of like if he's put in the Tom Brady category of being that mentally advanced. The offense, like you said, it doesn't flow quickly. It seems like, now maybe that's the scheme that they're doing all this downfield passing stuff. I don't think that's necessarily
true.
They're
not. That's part of the problem.
Yeah. So it's like, there's not the speed and the quickness in the offense that you would expect from this quarterback who we're all talking about as a top three mental quarterback before the snap. And then you've got this awesome wide receiver group. And I mean, the O-line didn't have their best game yesterday, but on the whole, a relatively good offensive line. It just doesn't seem like things are flowing and they're quick. And again, I mean, obviously I talk about Mahomes a lot, but like when he came onto the scene, it was the rhythm passing game. It was Andy Reid's base rhythm pass game that made him so good. And then Pat put a spin on it on the secondary stuff. But that offense doesn't work. And we see this all the time with Pat. He catches the ball. He knows where to go. Ball's out. Like, guys get pressure. It doesn't matter because the ball's out. And so we just don't seem to see that enough from Dallas. And I think everyone shares some blame, but we're all talking about this offensive coordinator's potential, you know, hot head coaching candidate because of the offensive coordinator skills. I personally just don't quite see it right now.
You look at just how spread out it can be and how static it can look. And you know, their version of doing some interesting things is lining up in those jumbo packages with the diamond formations in the backfield with both those. And that's fun every once in a while, right? They got like a nice chunk play action gain for like 12 yards off of that. Because if you're lining up like that, you're hopefully they're going to just cram people into the box. You're going to have a base cover three shell on the outside, and you're going to have a lot of cushion underneath because there are three defensive backs out there. That's exactly what happened. Play action pass off that easy 12-yard chunk gain. There isn't much of that, though. They don't use a lot of play action. They use a lot of spread out formations. I mean, it just, I want to see more schemed up chunk plays where you're just saying, listen, you don't need to go 1 to 2 to 3 here. This is your number one option. He's going to be open. There is not a lot of that when you watch this team play. There just aren't a lot of schemed opportunities for those receivers. And when you have this much talent, it's really underwhelming when you kind of watch it go again, like I did this morning, go back and watch it in succession, all of those plays. It's like, this is not that interesting. And we're really allowing and hoping that the quarterback's acumen will carry us here along with the personnel. And sometimes that's not enough when you're playing against a really good defense that's on your shit the entire day.
Yeah. So that, you know, reminded me of the Chiefs game. So last week, the last game of the season, Mecole Hardman for the Chiefs had his first 100-yard game. A lot of those receiving yards were little bubbles and, you know, kind of simple dink and dunk stuff, but he catches it. He's obviously got elite speed. There's two blockers out in front. The third guy who's covering Mecole either gets boxed out or he makes a move and the guy misses. So what do the Chiefs do? Obviously, Mecole had a great game. He's feeling it. He's feeling good about himself. Second play of the game, they have an RPO and same thing. It's a bunch formation. Mecole's the guy that gets the pass. Now it doesn't work out. Maybe the team was spying on it, but usually Pat's got a pretty good sense of if he should throw it. But like, they go to the guy and they get him the ball in the same situation that was successful. And they say, all right, let's keep feeding this. Like, I know there was a stat that CD didn't have a catch until late in the game. He did have one catch. It came back for holding. So it's not like
he was completely... That was a broken play. That's an extended play.
Yeah. So it's like, you would think at some point you say, okay, my best guy's not getting the ball. I'm going to do this little simple thing to get the ball in his hands. I mean, he's the punt returner, so he's dynamic in space. So how you can go a whole half and not just say, all right, let's get CeeDee the ball. Let's get, you know, Tyreek the ball. Like, you just have to do it at some point. And to your static point, you know, that was the big criticism of McCarthy in his last years in Green Bay. It was the same two formations. Nobody moved. No one did anything. He ran slant, flat combos and double slants and all this simple stuff. Do you feel like Moore has regressed over the last 2 years? And if so, do you think there's a bit of McCarthy where he wants to kind of simplify things and make things a little bit more static?
My guess, if I were trying to just throw out hypotheses, one of the reasons that the Packers were so static in the last few years under McCarthy is because Rodgers wanted it that way. He loved the fact that the picture didn't move. He knew exactly where people were going to be, why they were going to be there, how to set protections. He didn't want to use motion and all of these different things. Part of my assumption is that they're leaning into Dak's ability to see the picture before the snap and what makes him comfortable. And I feel like they have to kind of break out of that a little bit. And we talked about this with Nate last night. You know, one of the reasons they retained Kellen Moore and they've kind of kept all of this continuity with the system and the way they play offense is because Dak is so comfortable with it. But I think they've almost retreated into that comfort to the point where they've become staid. And that is a problem, in my opinion.
Right. And the thing with Aaron is he was basically doing the Peyton Manning, which is you have a 2x2 and a 3x1 formation. You line up. You have the first play that's called. You do it pretty quickly. And then the defense gives its look and you can choose from any of 9 or 10 plays. But I feel like Dallas doesn't do that either. Like, I don't really see Dak at the line completely changing plays and starting new plays. We see him all the time manipulating, you know, third downs and where the blitz is coming from and those types of things. But
it's protections.
Right. He's not lining up in a 2x2 formation on 2nd and 8, faking a play call and then just completely coming up with 1 of 8 plays to call. I don't see that. So if they are doing that and leaning into it, they're not doing it in the way that's really advantageous and that has the quarterback able to pick from this whole array of plays. So I don't know. I'm just relatively unimpressed by the offense as a whole. I think, you know, Kellen Moore's star is going down a little bit, and this offense is super fun when it's clicking, but it seems like, I know this isn't the case, it just seems like a lot of empty stats. Like, they have all the stats and the points and stuff. It just doesn't seem like one of the top units that we think it should be.
My thing is, and this will always be something I throw in there, it's almost to the point of parity at this point with them, I truly believe it. This team being in the bottom third of the league in play action rate and explosive plays created on play action, all that, that just can't happen. Like, you just cannot sit there when you're a team that is paying $20 million or whatever they are to your running back and you have this offensive line and you don't have a play action aspect to who you are offensively, especially when you've struggled to push the ball down the field and create splash plays in the passing game. Like, that is just a way to manufacture those. I'm going to throw this out there and I'm going to see if you think it's totally off base, because I just thought of it and I'm workshopping the take on you. In a way, watching Dak and just how quickly he moves through some of these progressions and how often he can make the right decision, but how at times making the right decision kind of defangs what they look like offensively, kind of reminds me of what Derek Carr has looked like at points in his career. Do you think that's a fair comparison?
That's interesting. I can definitely see it. I still think Carr does drive the ball down the field more
he does now.
Than we think. Yeah.
He does over the last 2 years. Before that, this is like 2018 Derek Carr is kind of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I can definitely see it. I was workshopping something, kind of as you said, you were workshopping something, which is Kellen Moore, obviously not the strongest armed quarterback in his heyday. Do we think that he kind of regresses to the mean in terms of what he's comfortable with and calls these shorter things and doesn't drive the ball down the field as much because those aren't the things that like he was personally as successful with as a quarterback? And so he tends to think like, oh, the short stuff, the quick stuff, smart quarterback football, not necessarily like we have an Allen or a Mahomes and we can drive the ball down the field at all times.
I like that. I can understand that. It does feel like there's some coaches that go the other way though, when they get just the, because think about what Andy can do with Pat and how it's opened up this entire world to him of like rainbows and sunshine that he never had before. Because while Alex was, again, such a great cerebral quarterback, there just isn't that aspect to it. So when you get it, you feel like you have to lean into it. That being said, Dak doesn't have like a rocket launcher for a right arm. I mean, he has to win in those ways.
Yeah. I mean, he's got, I would say, average to above average arm strength, though. It's not like he's to like three crow hops to get at 45 yards. But I will say, Andy Reid is much more like attacking mentality than people probably give him credit for, because he doesn't really let the media see like how competitive he is and how much he really wants to, you know, attack really in all aspects of what he does. And so the Alex Smith years, he was playing to his personnel. This offense, I think, as you're saying, has basically unlocked what he wants to do at his heart. Like, he is an aggressive guy, doesn't necessarily manifest itself in his outward demeanor or whatever, but I think we can tell by having the personnel, like, this is his favorite version of football and being able to basically play like NFL blitz and just throw the bomb every play and drive it down the field. It's a pretty fun thing to do.
The other thing I'll say about the Cowboys offense before we move on, their line has a sterling reputation, right? And we talk about them as though they're the best offensive line in football. They got beat up yesterday. They got outplayed yesterday by the Niners front without Bosa for two-thirds of the game. It doesn't matter who it was. DJ Jones, Kevin Givens, Arden Key, all of those guys took advantage of the non-Zach Martin interior players along the Cowboys' offensive line. So if you're looking at 2022 offensive line spending, okay, the Cowboys are number three. They are number three in the NFL in offensive line spending. This is without a starting left guard. Connor Williams is a free agent. You're spending $17.5 million on Tyron Smith, $15.2 million on Lyle Collins. I would venture to guess that might be the most expensive tackle duo in the league. Tyron is going to be 32.
By cap, maybe, but the Eagles have $18 million at both tackle spots.
I wasn't sure if my lotto was making that much. Okay, so the Eagles are right there. All right. So maybe it's top three
for
that. And so you look at that line yesterday, and Biadasz and Connor Williams did not have good days. No. And if you're going to have those spots kind of pull you down as a unit, and that unit no longer becomes like an undeniable strength, then it's just one more thing we have to kind of question about the way we talk about and the way we see the Cowboys offense.
Right, and I think those tackles, I think, are overpaid at this point, at least in
cap. Tyron's not getting any younger.
Right, Tyron's been hurt pretty much all these years. The nagging stuff seems to last a little bit longer on him. He hasn't had a fully healthy season in quite a while. We saw him get beat by guys that we don't even remember what name they are a few times yesterday. That just never
Charles
Omenihu. Right. It to me, it looked like, I know he had like the ankle thing and maybe an elbow or whatever, but it looked like his back was kind of hurting him again. Like, he was very, very stiff and rigid, much more than he typically is. And being pushed back into the quarterback a couple times, that never happens for him. He's like the strongest dude ever when he's got hands on you. So he was clearly affected by his injuries, and that just seems to be a recurring thing with him. Lyle, I mean, $15 million is a pretty high cap hit. It's probably top five for right tackles. I think he's a good player. I don't think he's a top five guy consistently. So that's, you know, a lot of money for guys that, I mean, Lyle's still young, so you could, you know, say he'll still improve a little bit. But as you said, Tyron's not getting younger. He's not necessarily getting healthier. So that one's looking tricky. I mean, Zach Martin's really the only one that's properly paid, probably still underpaid if you want to really look at it. So, yeah, I mean, four out of five spots are looking at trying to get some money back, get some value back, or needing to replace guys.
And that, I think, speaks to the larger conversation about this team, because we talk about them and think about them as, oh, well, you know, the roster's still really good. We'll sit there in August next year and be like, oh, yeah, the roster's still really good. But the defense is going to take a step back. The offensive line maybe isn't the unquestioned strength that we think it is. So if you just kind of rationalize the ending and say, well, they're a 12-5 team. You know, they're a high scoring team in the NFL. You know, this thing goes right, this thing goes right. It's a dangerous game to me. It feels like a dangerous game, but it feels like a game, especially after what Stephen Jones said today about McCarthy absolutely being back, that we're almost destined to play again next summer and going into next season.
Yeah, well, good for us. It gives us a lot to talk about and a lot to bitch about on Twitter, which I know we all love. So I think we are the winners here.
All right. We did not talk about this at all on the show last night with Nate. I want to talk about it, though, because you mentioned it yesterday and a lot of people have mentioned it. Do we need 14 playoff teams? Do we need 7 teams in each conference? And are we, is this a bit of recency bias where the blowouts are shaking our faith in the structure, but in reality, it's not as bad as the games this weekend might indicate?
Well, it's absolutely recency bias. That's without a doubt. Everyone's doing the, oh, well, it could have been the Chargers instead of Pittsburgh, and it could have been the Saints instead of Philly, blah, blah, blah. But like, yeah, you're still looking at the 13th and 14th best teams in the NFL. And the other thing that I haven't
come on. Well, let's not dismiss this so quickly. Getting to watch Justin Herbert instead of Ben Roethlisberger this weekend is a world of difference. A world of difference.
And yet, we've talked about this. He couldn't manage to get them to the playoffs over broken Ben. So you can talk to your son and tell him to do better next year.
It's not about results. It's about the experience of watching them play this weekend. One would have been significantly better than the other, even if we don't think the Chargers would have won a playoff game. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. So here's my thing. The seventh team, I think, isn't necessary. We typically don't need extra teams. We don't need to expand college football, normal football, whatever. The thing that I think people aren't realizing is that it's forcing the seventh best team to now play the second best team, where before the second best team didn't play anybody. So you had 3 versus 6, and those teams were much closer in talent level. And then 4 versus 5, obviously, 2 much closer talent level situations. Having 2 not get a bye and playing 7, you're setting yourself up for these types of situations every year. Now, of course, we don't expect this to be the outcome every single year. We expect more competitive games. And of course, as you said, if it was the Chargers in that slot, like they played the Chiefs really tight twice this year. If it was the Saints in the other slot, like they've got a great defense and they've always played Tampa tough. So there's a chance that these are really tough and competitive games, and even that one of the seventh seeded teams wins. But I think on the whole, over time, you're having better teams play lesser teams, and that is going to be a bigger chance of blowouts. And it's getting to be, so I described it as when Thursday Night Football sucked and Monday Night Football had some games for a while. I think there was a little bit of football fatigue and like, oh man, I really don't want to watch Texans against Jags again on Thursday Night Football. Well, in a playoff weekend where there's 6 games and those are all happening one at a time and you can't watch any other football during that, like you're just stuck watching it. And if the games suck, they suck and they drag forever and it feels kind of crappy. Like there was 3.5 of the 5 games just dragged on and on, and they felt like, oh man, this can be over. So that's not a great feeling.
You watched, man. Yeah, you watched.
I had to prepare to do this podcast.
And they know that. we're all going to watch.
Oh, I know.
And they know that.
We're never going back. It's not going to dilute the product. It's not going to lead to any sort of negative stuff. I just feel like on the whole, we both know, we watch enough football, like that game's probably not totally necessary. Again, we're never going back. This is the new reality. The positive for me as a viewer and being able to have multiple TVs in one spot, and for you as a viewer, like if you do have 2 TVs, your wife can sit there the entire time and watch whatever she wants on her TV. And it's not like a normal Sunday where I'm like, all right, it's noon. There's going to be 12 games on from now until 6:30. Like I need both TVs. So the viewing experience is a little bit better, I think, for the spouse. And I think Brooke had a little bit better weekend than a typical Sunday where I just go downstairs for the rest of the day.
I'm a psycho. So I have the game going on 2 TVs at the same time. And I have the second TV set about 30 seconds behind the first TV.
Oh, it's too far behind.
And, well, it's because I play with it. So I use the second TV to like rewind and watch plays when there's downtime going in the game or when it's a commercial break. Typically, I would want like 12 seconds is the right amount of time. and then I would look up and that's what it would be. But that's what I do, is I go back and watch the plays again on the second TV.
Yeah, so I was doing that with the Manning cast earlier this year, where I had the normal feed on, like, I think 8 seconds ahead or something. I forget which I ended up going with. I think the normal feed was about 8 seconds ahead, so I could like watch that. And then I might have actually had it flipped. I might have had Manning cast on slightly ahead, and then the normal feed like a few seconds behind. So the play would happen, because they're not really like announcing it as it happens all the time. They'd kind of talk about it, and then 10 seconds later, I can go look and like watch the play again and see kind of what they were saying in application. So I understand the two TVs and watching the same thing on two of them. I think that's nuts. I don't think that's necessary. I think you can, I tend to just rewind that given play, press play, fast forward. And by the time I do that, the next play is just about to
get
snapped.
I'm going to miss something though. So that's why I got to make sure that I have one going on real time all the time. And it's also nice, like in commercial, you know when it's going to come back. So during the commercials, I watch the second TV. It works for me.
I know. I'm not saying it doesn't work, but I think you're giving into your neuroticism where sometimes you have to push back against it.
I think that's probably fair, but that's how I've done it. So if we look at this, okay, obviously the two versus seven games were a disaster. Last year, do you know what the 2-7 games were last year? Do you remember?
I know we got to watch Mitch Trubisky pretend to be a quarterback for a while.
We sure did. Bears Saints was the 2-7 game, the Nickelodeon game last year. Totally superfluous, unnecessary. Not, that game did not need to happen in any way. If that game hadn't happened, I don't think we would have seen the last year of the Matt Nagy era. So thank you very much, National Football League, for allowing that to happen. In the AFC, though, the 2-7 game was Buffalo and the Colts, which was a very good, very fun game to kick off the playoffs last year. So, yeah.
I know. I don't know. Look, more often than not, they're going to be competitive. We got crushed by, again, three games being not competitive, and then the fourth game being not competitive for about three quarters and then getting good at the end. So I understand it's recency bias. These games aren't usually going to have that outcome. It's just, on the whole, you're introducing more scenarios where teams are mismatched against each other, as has been borne out by the course of the season and their seeding.
Yeah, I think that there are definitely a lot of different outcomes and timelines where those games are much, much better. You know, if the Colts get in, it just happened to be that the NFC did not have seven teams this year, right? They just didn't. There were six teams because the Saints just fell off. Their offense was not there. The Vikings weren't there. There was a void there with that seventh team. But there are two teams that could have gotten in to the AFC playoffs that didn't, that would have made those games better. And the Raiders game was fine to watch. It's one of those things, we're not going to have football in like a month, and I'm going to be annoyed about it. So having a couple shitty games that we have to watch on Wildcard Weekend, I'll suffer through it.
So
it's already over.
You just said, well, the Raiders game was fine. That was the best game of the weekend. And your feeling was like, well, I guess it was fine to watch that. The best game of the weekend was, I guess it was fine. So that tells you how the slate of football ended up.
I think that's probably fair. All right. The Chiefs are in the playoffs. There is no reason to not use you as a resource to discuss what happened during the Chiefs games as long as they're playing. You have some rare insight here. So when you watched that game last night, tell me if I'm wrong in feeling this way, but it just kind of felt like vintage Mahomes, like back to launch mode. I don't know. It had a feeling of like a 2019, 2020, 2018 Chiefs game in a way that a lot of their games haven't this year.
Like specifically the 2019 playoffs where the Chiefs spotted every team at least 10 points and then scored a bunch of touchdowns in a row.
Yes.
Yeah.
Specifically,
it felt exactly
that.
Like the 2019 game against Houston, except we didn't get down 28-3 or whatever. It was just down 7-0. So I actually left that game feeling more discouraged than encouraged.
Really?
Yeah, because if that was any other team and the Chiefs had like four straight three and outs and then a turnover for a fumble, if that happened against the Bills, they would have been down 17-0, right? If the Chiefs start a game, four straight drives, don't score any points, and then have a turnover that leads to another team scoring a touchdown, against all these other teams, they're going to be down multiple scores, and the tenor of the game just feels a lot different. And you know that Broken Ben isn't back there and you're going to be fine anyway. Like, it's much different, I think, if you're playing another team that is competent on offense. So I'm a little discouraged that like that happened. I'm very encouraged, obviously, by the six straight touchdown drives. Once they got rolling, it felt a lot more like 2019, and it felt like old Chiefs, deep passes, long shots, kind of the whole spectrum of the playbook, the stuff that all these teams were supposed to be taking away with the two high stuff. Like, they played the right defense on the long pass to Kelce, but Coach Reed just had, you know, a better play call and better pass protection, and Travis gets open for a 30-yard pass. You know, you're not supposed to be able to hit Tyreek 40 yards downfield for touchdowns anymore. He was wide-ass open. So, yeah, all that stuff is encouraging. I just felt like there was still a little bit too much of the early season 2021 Chiefs in there, and that's going to manifest itself against these better teams, especially this upcoming week against Buffalo. I tend to be a warrior by nature, so I tend to dwell on the negative a little bit more than the positive. I think part of the reason that we're also down throughout the course of the year is because of the expectation. Like, we just expect them to score a touchdown every time, and we know that's not necessarily the case, but like, I don't know, that first quarter and a half just kind of gave me the like, okay, this still isn't the complete team that we want them to be, and it was a little disconcerting.
Is there an aspect that you feel like is particularly troubling, something that you think could carry over, that if they don't get this fixed, it's going to be an issue?
I don't think so, because the whole year it's been one thing here, one thing there. Like, oh, it was a holding call, it was a drop pass, it was a tip ball, it was this other thing. Like, Mahomes has made plenty of those passes, you know, kind of back to the middle of the field. That wasn't even necessarily a dangerous one. Watt just happened to be there. Like, that gets tipped and intercepted. So it's kind of one-offs in all these situations. It's never like, okay, they just need to fix, like, the O-line in this case, or they need to fix drops in this case, and if they just catch the ball. Like, it's throughout the course of the year been a little bit of everything, and it was a little bit of everything at the start of the game as well. So it's just, again, had that feeling of this is the bad version of the Chiefs we've seen this year. Now they flipped the switch, and for 2.5 quarters it was the best version of the Chiefs, and 48-0 looks pretty good, or 42-0, whatever it was. We all know that's in there. We just want that consistency of being able to do it down after down. So I think that that's kind of the expectation. That's why I felt a little bit discouraged, because it's Pittsburgh. We all know Pittsburgh's not that great. They've got, you know, 3 stars on defense, and Coach Reed can pretty much scheme up how to defeat the front four. We saw him do that multiple times in my career in this past couple years. So, yeah, I don't know. I just get that nagging feeling that, like, they're a little bit too inconsistent, and if they face the right team who's playing well, like, they'll put themselves in a hole that they can't get out of. And obviously, I don't want to see that.
So I want to get to a voicemail question that we got from a listener about some of the specifics of the Chiefs game last night.
Hey, guys. So I have a couple questions for you. I'm a pretty big Chiefs fan, and I've been having a good time enjoying watching this year them play and develop, and more particularly their offensive line develop with them being so new. So I think I have 2 questions involving them, that one Nate and Robert brought up on the Monday show, and then a question that Nick Wright brought up that I think Robert let's speak about last night. So the first one is the screen game, how that has developed in the, you know, last game, and over the years how they've decreased it and increased it more so maybe towards the end of this year with that line developing. And my second question is, that Nick Wright brought up, he said that the line might be more of a detriment in some ways because it gives a clean pocket for Mahomes a lot of the times and does maybe limit his ability to scramble and create plays. So thanks, guys. Have a good one.
But first things first, what do you think about the screen game? Why do you think that we saw it a little bit more last night? Why do you think it hasn't been as much of a staple of the Chiefs offense over the last couple of years as it has been at other times in Andy's career?
Well, it's definitely been there this year. They've done really well on screens. I think it's mostly personnel related. Again, Coach Reed loves screens. He's loved screens for 20 years. It's been a big part of his offense. I would imagine the past few years, we just didn't have the personnel that was as consistent in space and being able to make kind of those decisions and stick on guys and do the things that we've seen, you know, Tooney, Creed, and Trey Smith do.
Do you think the moving pieces up front are part of it too? The fact that it's been a lot of different lineups kind of shuffling in and out, when this year they've really had most of the same guys in there for most of the year?
I think that's definitely part of it. But I thought this was going to be a huge screen year, because whenever we watched other teams do screens, it usually was Tooney, and it was him being a baller on a screen. And like, he was the teach tape from his New England days. So I was like, all right, he's going to fit in great. They're going to run a ton of screens to the left. Creed has obviously been awesome in space. Trey kicks ass wherever he is. So yeah, having those three guys gives you the confidence that they're going to get on guys in space, make the right decisions. There's a lot of decision making on screens. Doesn't necessarily seem like it. There's also some pre-snap awareness that guys have to be in tune with. And again, those three have done a good job with that. Yesterday in particular, I mean, that's the fastest running back the Chiefs have had back there in a while. And I think a little bit of speed and juice is an asset in the screen game, being able to pull away from a defensive lineman who's chasing, or being able to juke a guy in space and set the lineman up. And again, if things get a little bit delayed, you've got the speed to get you out of a bad situation. So I think it's a combination of everything. They definitely have the right personnel to be running these screens. Again, we've seen it all year. I think coach just doesn't want to rely on any one thing too much. The screen is a great asset, and I think there is a way to overdo it.
Do you think another part of it might be that Mahomes never gets blitzed? There aren't that many advantageous looks that the Chiefs will see in a given game compared to what other teams might face when considering screens.
No, because I think screens are great against blitzes, but you don't necessarily go into a game thinking like, all right, they're going to run this pressure and then we're going to screen it over their head. You know, the screens allow a lot of weird things to happen because O-linemen are ditching defensive linemen, and there's probably going to be one or two guys unblocked, and now the quarterback's going to have to maneuver, you know, blitzers and free runners and throw the ball over people, and the timing can get a little bit beat up. And then, you know, on these zone pressures, the defensive end's dropping, and what if you're throwing it into the defensive end who's dropping into coverage, then he picks it. So I think a clean look, predictable coverage is almost better. And so, you know,
okay,
if it's, you know, man or zone, rules change a little bit. If it's man or zone, the coach can also scheme out certain things. You know, if it's this particular zone coverage against this route concept, like receivers don't just run vertical down the field and don't focus on anything. Like, there's routes that are attached to most screens, and that's part of the ruse, is it looks like a normal route concept. And so if you're playing Seattle and it's cover three, and you know they react this specific way, and maybe you can isolate one defender who's going to be the only guy left in space to throw to the running back, and now you've got two or three blockers on this one defender, like, that's advantageous. So I think coverage and static looks might actually be more beneficial. Now, the home run is like, you know, cover zero and you dump the ball off and the one guy who's supposed to be there gets picked off by a lineman. Like, that's the perfect scenario, but that does bring into play a few potential negative outcomes.
All right. Let's humor everyone here and entertain the second question, whether or not the pass protection could be too good for Patrick Mahomes.
The answer is no. having your quarterback fully protected and feeling comfortable and awesome in the pocket is never a bad thing, and he can still break the pocket plenty of times. Like, that's
like,
that's,
he does
something. Yeah, so I'm gonna be nice on this one and say it's more than beneficial when your offensive line's playing well for everyone on the team, quarterback especially, and there's a reason the teams put so much money into their offensive line to get that production.
All right, let's hit a couple of mailbag questions before we get out of here. Zach Ament says, I was wondering if Mitch could explain the difference in bye weeks during the regular season, when you know your next opponent, and the bye week during the playoffs, when you don't learn your opponent until the next week. Sunday in this case, the Titans and the Packers. Also, how does the additional wear and tear added since the first bye during the regular season impact the practice schedule during the playoff bye week? It's a great question. I actually don't know the mechanics of what a playoff bye week looks like.
Well, it's different for every coach. So Coach Reed traditionally during the season gives you a full week off. So there have been some playoff buys he'll do that, some playoff buys he doesn't. Typically, teams are going to put in maybe a little bit more work in the playoffs, and especially if you've got that bye, because any extra days are bonus days. You know, you don't necessarily have to capitalize and have a full week off when everyone else is having a normal practice week. So in terms of what to do if you're not like game planning because you don't know what team you're playing, well, that's not really on the players at all. So the advanced scouts and the people who are watching film, like, you kind of know typically three of the teams you could play. For the most part, you've played them or have some familiarity with them. And so you're doing kind of the first level of scouting and kind of the basic looks. And then once it's decided, you've done a little bit of prep on all the teams and you can really dive in. For the players, if you are practicing that week, it's typically back to fundamentals. And so you're able to really work on, all right, let's hone in on, say you're an inside zone running team, and a staple of inside zone running is double teams. And you feel like, oh, it's late in the year, we haven't practiced in pads in a couple months, the physicality is getting away from us. Like, you'll put the pads on, you'll have 20 minutes of individual period, and all you're doing is double teams and beating the crap out of each other and getting back to base fundamentals of physicality. And then typically in those situations, you're more likely to go up against your own defense, which you really haven't done since training camp. And I always hated because I don't really want to go up against like Frank Clark and Chris Jones in practice. There's a little bit more crossover from ones versus ones. Typically in a normal season practice, the only crossover you would have is in one-on-one, individual drills where you're doing one-on-one pass rush or one-on-one run block, or if you're doing a end of game 2 minute situation. But otherwise you're going against a scout team, they're shown a card, they're running a specific defense, and you don't really have to face any of the awesome guys. So the bye week practice, you don't know who you're playing for sure, so you're likely to kind of just go up against your own defense, get some work in, stay in shape. There might be certain practices or certain periods that are, carded against scout teams that, we just talked about screens. Maybe screens are a point of emphasis that week. And so you don't want to do, ones versus ones and just run 8 screens in a row. So maybe you have a carded period where it's a screen and play action period, and you can get specific work in a little bit lower stress environment. So it's kind of a combination of all that. The coaches can choose. Some of them will do it like an in-season week of work where, say Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, you're still showing up. It's just shorter hours and you kind of keep things consistent. Some will break it up so it's, Wednesday, Friday, Sunday, try to spread out the work a little bit more. Every coach has their own philosophy. It's usually molded by who they've coached with in the past, what has worked in the past. And then if you did one specific thing and maybe you got blown out that week, you're probably not going to go back to that same schedule. You're going to tweak it a little bit. Also, the amount of coaches that have multiple bye weeks in the playoffs in their career, it's probably a small group. So I think for this instance, I don't know that Vrabel's had a bye before. So he's probably going to do whatever Belichick did when he was playing, because that's what he's familiar with. And that's what, he knows worked for them. So you kind of, as a coach, revert back to either who coached you or who you also coach with in a similar situation. In terms of the game planning, it's much more technique oriented, and you're going against just your own defense to get in solid work against each other.
All right. Steven Valerio asks, watching the San Francisco-Dallas game, I saw the San Francisco right guard reach out and touch the center, and it got me thinking, how exactly does a silent count work? Great question. Simple question, but I feel like you can answer this in 10 seconds.
Oh, I could answer in 10 seconds. I could also answer in 10 minutes, which I probably will do. So the simple answer is the quarterback signals to someone that he's ready to get the ball. Somehow the center has to relay that information, and then the center does whatever the agreed upon cadence is and snaps the ball. That's the simple way to do it. So in that particular instance where the right guard is the one looking back, he's looking at the quarterback lifts his leg, that tells the right guard, all right, we're ready. The right guard then typically taps the center, so he feels this physical tap from his teammate. He now knows, all right, the quarterback has signaled him that we're ready to snap it. And then whatever agreed upon cadence you broke the huddle with, say it's, on one or on two or on three, whatever that is, the quarterback or the center then starts his, usually it's some sort of head movement, his head movement, and everyone's off, and it's kind of a timing thing. Now, some teams, I'd say most teams, have a guard looking back because they like the center to be able to look forward at all times. He can see the defense. He's the one in charge of making, the defensive declarations and the calls. So
it's also a weird angle with the guy right behind you.
Yeah. So having the center look between his legs, just waiting. Typically teams don't do that. The Chiefs actually do that, which is kind of funny enough. But most teams have a guard looking back to look at the quarterback. Then the center, his cadence is, it's an agreed upon thing you work with throughout the year. Again, it's typically some sort of head movement, like look left, look right, snap, look down, look up, snap. Some guys move their hand. They kind of like do a fake point, like point, back, snap. But the most important thing is that it's rhythmic. You want your offensive tackles especially to be able to tune into it, time it out. Philly does a great job of it. It's basically just like Kelsey gets tapped. He just like wiggles his head really quick and snaps the ball. Most centers don't love snapping the ball when their head is moving, so that makes him an outlier more than the other guys. Typically, the timing mechanism is move your head, come back to center, then snap, because centers very much like when their head is static and they don't have to block 350-pounders as their head's moving, and maybe they have to run in the opposite direction while also throwing a ball between their legs accurately to the quarterback. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing. Every team has kind of their own little variation of it, but a proper silent cadence is awesome for the offensive line and for the tackles. Alex Mack was the best I ever played with in terms of consistent timing. In 2015, Joe and I convinced the team to do silent cadence at home on certain third downs because we thought we got a better jump than doing just the quarterback's verbal cadence. So we would be at home. I remember like we did silent count and it was against Oakland and it was against Denver, and you don't, as a defensive lineman, expect the home team to be doing silent count. So it like kind of confuses them. And then also we timed it so perfect. It just gave us that little bit of a jump for, you know, Khalil Mack, Alden Smith, Von Miller, those guys.
That's awesome. You've never told me that before. That's a really, really fun story. All right. Last question. All right. Gerald Torner says, I have a question that's been torturing me for at least a decade. If you can answer, I'd be grateful. Wow. When a new coach comes in and gets hired, you hear about them installing an offense during OTAs and minicamp. What exactly does that mean? How do you install an offense in a way in which an entire roster can memorize it? What does this process look like? Again, you don't have to go through the whole thing here, but enough to satisfy Gerald's torment here.
So everything is written out. So you've got your playbook. These days it's more digital than paper, even though I always like the paper and being able to flip through. So say you're installing your base run play. You kind of go over like the rules before that. Like every playbook has what's an A gap, what's a B gap, what's a two tech, what's a three tech. Like you've got the simple stuff that by the time you get to the NFL, you pretty much know. Coaches will kind of cover that quickly, get through it, get through the cadences, and then you get down to the actual plays. So the run play gets shown up. You've got the formation, the play call, all that stuff, you know, trips right bunch, 94 week, blah, blah, blah. You wouldn't run that play out of that formation, but that's what came to mind. The offensive line sees, okay, this is single back inside zone. You know, some of the play sheets are just like the pictures and you just kind of look at the pictures and you learn from that. Some of them, you know, they all pretty much have specific rules. So on 94 week, you know, play side tackle, you're the open end tackle, block the end man on the line of scrimmage. Right guard, you know, if you're covered, you're going to block the defense lineman covering you. If you're uncovered, you're going to work to the call linebacker. You know, for the center, it'll say who to make the call linebacker. You know, again, if you're covered, block that guy. If you're uncovered, work to the call linebacker. So everyone pretty much has a rule. And some guys learn by seeing all the pictures and being like, okay, this is this play against all these defenses. Now I got it and I understand. Some guys need to know the rules and they're very rule-based because the rule should be the static thing. If you go up to the line of scrimmage, it should apply to any defensive look you're going to see. Some guys just need to watch the film. They need to see it in action. And then some guys need to be on the field and actually feel it in a walkthrough or practice situation. So for the most part, it's all on a screen, on a projector. You go through all the plays. You explain all the things to all the players and what their rules are. The position groups break off. You more specifically go over that stuff. You know, our offensive line coach isn't peppering us with all the minutia while the receivers are just sitting there bored. You do that in your own room, and then you watch enough film and you have enough walkthroughs and you go through enough things that ideally everyone learns it and has a grasp of it.
We did a walkthrough every practice right after we got done out of the classroom, and it was the only way I could understand it. Like, we'd watch a lot of film and everything would be up on the board, and I'd be like, all right, like, we'll just wait till we get out there. Every single day, it's called STT, set the tone. So our walkthrough, initial walkthrough as soon as we get out there, and then you'd split off and you'd go do another little short kind of walkthrough thing with your position group, and then it was inside run every single day.
That's it's funny because some guys, like I play with Sean Lavau in Cleveland, like he wasn't a guy, he hated going up to the whiteboard. He couldn't necessarily like draw everything perfect in the formation and this stuff, but like, you put him on the field, everything made sense to him. He didn't have missed assignments. He knew exactly what to do. Like, he was awesome to play with too. He was an ass kicker. But like, he wasn't a guy, if you just only had him go up and write on the whiteboard, you'd be like, oh, this guy doesn't get it. But like, on the field, it just clicked and it worked for him. Like, people learn in such different ways. And that's what these best coaches, they realize what their guys need and how to do it. And they kind of teach in all those manners so that if a guy's more of an on-field guy, he can learn. If he's a film guy, he can learn. If he's a rules guy, he'll learn. But definitely as coaches, understanding how your players learn and applying that, that's a huge thing to getting the most out of them.
All right. That's all we got. Another one in the books. If you guys have not, please go listen to the Monday night recap that I did with Nate Tice a little bit earlier today. Would love it if you guys did that. Wanted to remind you, starting tomorrow on Wednesday on the Athletic Football Show, Dane Brugler, Lance Erlein bringing their draft show weekly to the feed all the way through the draft. They're going to be here every single Wednesday. I'll join them every so often. Dane and Lance will come on here. It's going to be great. Please go check out their stuff. They're going to start with just a layout of what draft season looks like, what the top 10 could look like, what this class is like, what sort of quarterback options are out there, who could be some risers, fallers, talk about Dane's initial or second mock draft, excuse me, that comes out on Wednesday. So I highly encourage you guys to go check that out. We will be back. I will be back on Thursday with Lindsey Jones. Until then, appreciate you guys listening. Please rate and review the podcast on your podcast platform of choice. It's the end of the season. If you guys like the show, if you've enjoyed it, let us know. Go leave us 5 stars. Go leave us a review. If you didn't like the show, don't do anything. Just hang out. Also, please subscribe to The Athletic, theathletic.com/football show. So much great stuff every single day, breaking down every playoff game from every single angle. Highly encourage you guys to get a subscription if you do not have one. Please go check out Lance and Dane tomorrow. We'll be back on Thursday. Appreciate you guys listening. Talk to you soon.
This was The Athletic Football Show.